So tonight we turn to the Shakti tradition, the concept of the Mahadevi, the great goddess. Her worship in India, as around the world, must be immemorial. We find the presence of the goddess in the texts of the Rig Veda. We find her making luminous appearances in at least one Upanishad, the Kena Upanishad. We see the idea of the supreme nature, Paraprakriti, playing a pivotal role in the development of the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita and the idea of its cosmology and hints about its future possibilities. But we don't see, to this point, the goddess tradition itself. But let's think about the remnants of the spiritual literature that we have extant to us. Who pays for the recitations to continue? Who pays for the texts, the manuscripts, to be written again and again and again? Seats of royal power. If there was an indigenous goddess tradition in India, it could have been left to the side because it would not have been supported by kings who were interested in the Brahmanical heritage, carrying forward the Vedic lineage. If they had been part of the society from the very beginning, perhaps this wouldn't have been so, but the Aryan culture does not originate in India. It comes from outside. When we arrive at the first appearance of the great goddess on the scene in India, it is from a non-Vedic source, and the names used are non-Sanskritic. Chandika, she who is fierce, she who is terrible, is one of the first names we meet, and it is not Sanskritic. The first great hymnal that we have about the Mahadevi is the Devi Mahatmyam. We can date it to about 400 to say 600 CE. Likely, as an oral tradition, it could be older, but at this point it was interpreted from whatever vernacular languages it might have existed into, Sanskrit. It comes into Sanskrit about then. Remember, Sanskrit means perfected. Prakrit means of the people. So there were Prakritic languages moving about while Sanskrit might have been the language of the poets and of the courts. What the people spoke is very different. Look at the Buddha speaking in Pali, speaking in Magadhi. So we can't say that there wasn't a tradition prior to the arrival of this Sanskrit document in these early centuries CE, but we don't have any evidence of it. But knowing that a matrilineal and a goddess-centered culture existed from Neolithic times on across the globe means it must have been there in India as well. But finally, it pushes its way from what must have existed among the common people into the courts, because now manuscripts start getting written of the Devi Mahatmyam, the glory, the greatness of the Divine Mother, of the goddess. In fact, there are so many that they're almost innumerable. So once it got transported into Sanskrit and was made available, it became very popular and is accorded a kind of respect that we see normally associated with the Veda, with the Rig Veda, because this hymnal, also called Durga Saptashati, the 700 verses given to Durga, is to be said in a piece. You can't play lightly with this text. When you read it at the right hour, in the right way, and you do the whole text. And then the auspicious good comes to you because you have honored the mantra. The goddess lives in the mantra. Now, in coming weeks, we're going to take a look at the great Shakti, the Mahadevi, the great goddess, and see how it gets enacted into tantric life. We're not going into the tantra tonight. We're simply going to make some introductory comments about the worship of the Divine Mother. And so we begin with this idea that it must have existed long before it arrives in this manuscript form, but now it becomes popular. And there's a frame story in the Devi Mahatmyam, and then three important myths occur within it. The first myth is about an old friend that we know from the Mahabharata some centuries before, Madhu and his good buddy Kaitaba, who are on a rampage and have to be silenced. It goes like this. In between the cosmic cycles, Vishnu is sleeping coiled on top of Shesha, the infinite serpent, who is his energy. And as he sleeps, Brahma, who is extended from his belly, sitting on a lotus on the top of the stem, is preparing to create a new universe. While Vishnu is sleeping, two thought forms take the debris that is in his ears and begin to fashion for themselves bodies and energies and worlds to move in. And they come after Brahma and say, "Not you, we'll create this new world." Vishnu is sound asleep. And in the tale that the Mahabharata gives us, and it's told several times completely in the Mahabharata, it is Brahma who shakes the stem of the lotus so vigorously that finally it arouses Vishnu, who then does great battle with these two and finally subdues and destroys them. We won't go into the details of that. But here in the Devi Mahatmyam, there's a departure. He is asleep, Vishnu, on Shesha, fallen into a deep state of repose under the influence of Yoga Nidra. Mahamaya has pulled him into a sleep state. The great goddess has lulled him into a sleeping posture. And when these two fellows, taking the debris from Vishnu's ears, start to come after Brahma, Brahma, instead of shaking the stem, puts his hands together and supplicates, saying, "Devi, please withdraw your power of Yoga Nidra. Please take the spell off him so that he will awake and fight and save the worlds." And so He has asked nicely, she has heard him, and she grants. And Vishnu arises from sleep. But what that tells us is that she has a great power over Vishnu, and in fact, is it possible for him to do anything without her? In the second of the stories, Mahisha, the great Asura, is rampaging through the world himself and has kicked the gods out of their heaven, and they've gone all up into the mountains and they're storming about, cussing like anything and angry, and they're twisting their faces and they're all mad, and their energies all pooled together form this great being who appears brilliantly in a fire. And she is the goddess. And they ask her to go to earth and fight Mahisha. And she agrees. Now, if you're paying attention to this, you're seeing a couple of scenes drawn to us that are symbolic of what mothers do. Mothers have umbilical cords by which they give birth to beings and, by extension, to worlds. How did Vishnu get that power, unless he's an extension of a mother goddess? This idea that the gods, getting angry, pool their energies together and then form this great goddess who will do battle puts it somewhat in reverse, because the gods are themselves children of the Divine Mother, aspects of her being. And I think it's likely that there was an earlier myth which depicted the goddess coming forward and saying, "All right, boys, stand aside. I've had enough of this," and decided herself to come down and face this Asura, Mahisha. And all the story is, to the interest of children, about the great battle between the two, but really, it's a short affair, because even though she takes a form that is smaller than his, and even though he is many-imaged, capable of shifting from one form to the other, he's neither clever enough nor powerful enough to escape her darts, and she, indeed, destroys him. There's a third frame story, of course, and that's the story about Shumba and Nishumba, and this is the one where one of them decides that, who is seen from afar, "Oh, there's a great goddess over there. She is really gorgeous." And the other says, "Really? Maybe I'd better go marry her," and presents himself as a suitor. And she says, "Oh, well, I can only marry the person who can defeat me in battle." He said, "But you're just a woman. You're meant for love. You're meant for things beautiful." She says, "Oh, well, nevertheless, if you can defeat me in battle, then you can marry me." And he's enraged and says, "All right, very well, we'll fight." Well, you know the end of the story already, don't you? There's something interesting, though, about this goddess power. She is not only called Mahadevi, she is also called Mahasuri. She is mother to the gods, and she is mother to the demons. She is the great reality. She is the reality beyond all male dominion. She is the original source of the world. She is the world herself. She is transcendent to the world, surely, but she somehow creates the world which floats in her being in a kind of panentheism. It's not that the body of the world is all of her, but it is a projection, an aspect of her. And the language used to describe this is, again, the Sankhyan language. What did we learn about the Sankhya? It is non-Vedic. It is non-Aryan. It is something indigenous to India. This goddess power constructs the worlds, oversees the worlds, and when she destroys the antagonistic hosts, she finds the means by which to reintegrate them into the cosmos. They are not thrown away, they are not utterly destroyed, but their essence is kept, and they're made to do better later. There's an idea that the worst among us is redeemable. And it should be so if the only thing that really exists is the great goddess. As my friend Ulrich once said when we were riding through the streets of Pondicherry on his motorbike, and we were talking about rebirth, he said, we can be recycled as many times as is necessary, as many times as it pleases us. And when the goddess is creating these worlds, it is meant to be for growth, for delight, for expanding being. She's identified with the Brahman. Brahman is one of her modes of reality. The energism of the cosmos is another. She stands in the heart of every individual. In these 700 verses, which have a kind of sanctity equivalent in the minds of many to those verses from the Gita, and remember the Gita is about 700 verses also, we have this earliest testament of the worship of the Divine Mother. It's not the only. There is the Devi Gita, which is not as early as this. It's probably as late as the 14th century. It comes after Ramanuja, the great Vishishtadvaitin thinker who talked to us of qualified non-dualism, that the soul is real and can enter into a kind of communion with the divine, but there's not an absolute identity between the two. You remember, we talked about that a few weeks ago. Ramanuja gives birth through his singular philosophic force to what becomes the great bhakti tradition in India. Begins in the south, moves to the north. And interestingly, those who follow his line are called Sri Vaishnavas. Sri is the name of the goddess. Goddess of beauty. Later she would be known as Lakshmi. But originally she was known as Sri. So when you carry that prefix, you mean to say that the presence of this beneficent goddess is with you. Her blessings are with you. Her force and power, her capacity to overcome all adverse circumstances is there. She is salvific. It means she saves. She bestows grace. She gives wealth. But most, she gives knowledge. She gives great transcendent knowledge so that you're freed from ignorance. And in the Devi Gita, we find so many corollaries taking us back to the Bhagavad Gita. There are 507 verses in this, not 700 like in the Gita, but they closely match in their themes what we saw there. One thing that is somewhat different is that Prakriti is not merely a material inconscient power. Prakriti is seen as being a goddess force. In Sankhya, Prakriti is active but insentient. Purusha is sentient but inactive. In this, Prakriti is a conscious power, creating the worlds for the sport of the divine. In the Devi Gita, there is more association with the idea of a male god. We have more of the presence of Shiva, more of the presence of Vishnu, etc. One other thing is that the idea of Kundalini Yoga arises here. So this is 14th century. You see, it's not that early. But unlike other disciplines, this explanation of the Kundalini Yoga follows closely the Eightfold Path of the Patanjala Yoga, that which was marked out in the Yoga Sutras, which we looked at recently. The tradition does not end with these two. There's also the worship of Vindhyavasini, and there is a complete myth and hymnal applied to her worship as well. She is very interesting because she is also known as Bhuvaneshwari, she who rules the worlds. And there is a particular place where she lives, which is where the Vindhya Mountains begin to spill over into the Gangetic Plain and into the Ganges itself. There's a great temple there, and blood sacrifices are offered. Chickens are sacrificed to her. They say, in fact, that the halls of the temple are never dry, because always the sacrifices are going on. But Bhuvaneshwari is the first that we hear of, who is a goddess who is worldwide, who is the center of everything. But she's the world dominatrix from there, from that point. That's the center. It's not that the center is everywhere. It has a very specific center and moves out from there. We have sort of an understanding today that the worship of the Divine Mother was of an omnipresent goddess who is everywhere, of whom all the gods are, and goddesses are other children. And perhaps she has, or perhaps she has not, a mate. Some myths say that she does, and some say that she does not. The earliest ones that we've seen have her standing singly. She is the great power from which all comes, gods and other goddesses too. But the idea of an all-India goddess is not present, because to this Bhuvaneshwari, who's sighted at that spot, that is the place where reality really resides. So it is local, you see what I mean, and then spreads out from there. When Sri Aurobindo writes of the Divine Mother, he is writing from a more universal perspective. He is not looking for citations. in the history of Indian spiritual literature, what he is drawing upon is his own experience of the Mahashakti from inside, not from outside. He's not looking for a starting point within the Indian context. He finds plenty of reinforcement from that. So when he writes about the centrality of the Adi Shakti, of the Mahashakti, and that there are four great personalities that come from that, knowledge and power and beauty and perfection and work, these have analogs in the Hindu tradition. Maheshwari, Mahakali, Mahalakshmi, Mahasaraswati. They are all there, and they appear in these very myths that we're talking about tonight. But for Sri Aurobindo, he had the experience first, and then later found the facts in the annals of Indian spiritual history. It was also true of his experience of the Vedas. He saw moving before him gods whom later he could identify when he had a chance to look at the Vedas and see who they were. They matched perfectly his inner experience of them. So when we read what Sri Aurobindo has to say about the mother, we need to recognize that it's based upon what he knew from his own inner being. Not something that he was an initiate into a tantric system that stretched back some 500 or 600 years. That is not so. He had a spiritual realization which disclosed to him the nature of these great powers and energies. And he wrote on the basis of that. And when he saw Mira Alfasa, he knew who she was, because he could recognize that force that had taken shape in her, as indeed that Mahashakti takes shape in all of us, but with a particular mission, with a particular force in her. And speaking of Sri Aurobindo and his insight into the mother's nature, it reminds me of M.P. Pundit, whose birthday was yesterday. Some of you were here, I think, for that 96th celebration of his Bonfet. There was a book commemorating his 50th birthday. Some of you may have seen it. There was an article that Rajagopal wrote, one of his good friends from Chennai, as we call it now, who called him Mother Prone Pundit. He said the M and the P stand for Mother Prone, because he inclined towards that. And Panditji was amused and published it in that that volume. A sweet sense to it. You'll know that Madhav had his first meeting with the mother while he was still a teenager. But when he moved to the ashram when he was 21, right out of school, you know, he was preparing to become an advocate, to become a barrister. When his father passed away, he gave him the opportunity, with his elder brother's permission and support and encouragement, to come and join the Sri Aurobindo ashram and to take up life living with Kapali Shastriya, his mentor and teacher. And so he became an upasaka of the Divine Mother. But even though he was serving as her secretary and as Nalini's helpmate in getting the life divine type, because he did such a beautiful, flawless job in typing, that he had occasion once to speak to the mother, and he said, "I see people really love you. And I have great regard for you. I have great respect. But I have to confess, I do not feel that love. And she said, really? And she just smiled at him. And he said, in his heart, suddenly, there burst forward this love. And he felt it moving as an energy in him, this melting love. And he said, it never stopped. He said, at the time when he was talking about this, he said, it is still continuing, just like that. So every movement that she made, every word that she said, was to him a revelation of grace and a lesson in life and an inspiration. Champaklal, after mother had left her body, told someone that she was working primarily through Madhavna. Much of her work was getting done through him. And why? Because he had identified himself with her. There was no room for anything in between. He lived in the mother's consciousness. This takes us back to the Indian tradition. You see, we make a complete circle and we come back, because if a devotee in the Shakta tradition applies conscious force to the act of personal offering to the divine, then all distance disappears and one lives in her. You become part of her being. You become an aspect of her projected into the world. These goddess powers that we've enumerated as four in the main can play in the disciple. Disciple because one follows the discipline. It is a discipline of oneness. In the heart it is love, in the mind it is knowledge, and in the act it is work. And this is how we are. When we live in communion with the divine, then we are hers. In the earliest innings of the Sri Vaishnava path, there is no distinction between Sri, the goddess, and Vishnu. They are always together. Because both are poles of one being. The same is revealed when we come to the Shiva Shakti tradition. Both are poles of the same being. And just so in us, there is a poise in which we are silent, indrawn, wise, at peace, and there is a poise where we're capable of joyful dancing, or terrible war if we have to destroy ignorance. So, now we're going to break with that paradigm that I put out some months back about how we would, I guess it's a schedule more than a paradigm, what we would do week to week, because I think that we want to dwell a little bit more on the tradition of the Devi and on the role that the Tantras play. And since we've already given full evenings to Sri Ramakrishna and Sri Ramana Maharshi and some other themes like that. Those which are penciled in the schedule, I think we may eliminate and either expand our look into some of these more interesting themes that are upon us right now, and or give a little context about what Sri Aurobindo was doing before and entering Pondicherry, leading up to the life divine. So I'll pause and see if you have any questions.